All right, let's dive into a case that really makes you think about what a fair trial means. Imagine this. You're convicted of murder, but you're saying, hold on, I didn't even understand the confession I gave.
Oh, that's a tough situation to be in.
Years later, you're trying to appeal, but there's a catch, a big one. Your lawyer, well, they messed up. Didn't object at the right time during the original trial.
Wow.
So now the question is, can a technicality really be the difference between freedom and spending life behind bars?
It's a huge question.
That's the heart of Wainwright v. Sykes, a 1977 Supreme Court case.
Yeah, Wainwright v. Sykes. This case totally changed the game for how prisoners can challenge their convictions in federal court. It's a real head-scratcher. It makes you think about the balance between fairness for individuals and the need for rules, you know, processes.
Processes, definitely. So let's get into the specifics here.
Okay, yeah.
This all begins with John Sykes, convicted of murder in Florida back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Years go by, and he's arguing that his confession, the one that helped put him away, shouldn't have been allowed in the first place. He says he was intoxicated, didn't understand his Miranda rights.
Oh, wow.
And that seems like a pretty big deal, right?
Huge, huge. And you would think, right, that if someone's rights were violated during questioning, they'd get a chance to fight that. But here's the twist, Sykes' lawyer. They never objected to the confession when it was presented at the trial.
Oh, so they missed that opportunity.
Yeah, they did. And now, years later, he's trying to raise this issue, and the courts, they got to figure out if that missed opportunity, if it completely blocks his appeal.
I was thinking about it. It's kind of like you miss your chance to challenge a call in a basketball game, right? You can't just wait until the game's over and be like, wait a minute, that was a foul.
Exactly. You can't just do that. There are rules for a reason, right? And in Wainwright v. Sykes, the Supreme Court, they really wrestled with this. They ended up ruling against Sykes and established what's called the cause and prejudice test.
Oh, cause and prejudice.
Yeah.
Okay, let's break this down. What exactly did the Supreme Court say?
They basically said that for a federal court to even consider an appeal like Sykes, the prisoner has to prove two things.
Two things, all right.
First, they've got to show cause. Like, why didn't they object in state court? Was it like their lawyer was incompetent? Did some new evidence come up later? And then they have to show prejudice, meaning did that error at trial, did it actually harm their case?
It's a pretty high bar.
It's a high bar to clear, definitely.
So it's not enough to just say, oops, my lawyer missed that.
Yeah.
You got to prove that it actually made a difference in the outcome of the trial.
That's exactly right. And the court, they didn't think Sykes cleared that bar. They didn't see enough evidence of, like, cause for the missed objection and the evidence against him. Already pretty strong.
So it sounds like they felt like even if they had objected, he still would have been found guilty.
Right, yeah. And this decision, it had a massive ripple effect. It made it much harder for state prisoners to appeal their convictions in federal court.
So what you're saying is this case is about way more than just one confession. It sets a precedent for how much authority federal courts have to step in state cases.
Exactly. Absolutely. Wainwright, it's a classic example of that tension between state and federal power in our judicial system. The Supreme Court, they decided to, like, put a lot of trust in the integrity of state court proceedings.
They're giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Right. They're basically saying, like, we're not going to second guess every single decision a state court makes unless there's a really, really good reason.
Which makes sense. You want to have some sort of system.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there could be some real risk here. What if someone's rights were genuinely violated in state court? Does this decision shut the door on them getting a fair hearing?
That's the question, isn't it? It's the million-dollar question, and it's what makes Wainwright so controversial, so debated. It forces us to grapple with that balance, respecting state courts, but also making sure individuals have access to federal review when their rights are really at stake.
It's a tough balance, for sure. To dig into that debate even further, can you remind us what habeas corpus is? And why it's important in this case.
Oh, habeas corpus.
A big one.
It's a big one, often called the Great Writ. It's this fundamental legal principle, goes back centuries.
Centuries? Wow.
It's basically a way for a prisoner to say, hey, court, you're holding me illegally. I have a right to a hearing to prove it.
So it's their way of challenging their detention.
Yeah.
So in this case, Sykes is using habeas corpus to say, hey, my confession, it was obtained illegally. It shouldn't have been used against me.
Exactly. And Wainwright, it changed the game for how federal courts handle these habeas corpus petitions from state prisoners.
Okay. I'm starting to see how this all fits together.
Yeah.
So before Wainwright v. Sykes, how easy was it for a prisoner to get a federal court to even look at their habeas corpus claim?
Well, before Wainwright, It was definitely easier than it is now. There is a key case before Wainwright, Faye v. Noya. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that basically a federal court could hear a habeas claim as long as the prisoner hadn't intentionally skipped the opportunity to raise it in state court.
So as long as they didn't do it on purpose.
Yeah, like intentionally.
Okay, so before Wainwright, the focus was on did the prisoner deliberately miss a step in state court?
Right.
But in Wainwright, the Supreme Court's saying, hold up, we need stricter
You got
rules.
it. The Wainwright majority, it was led by Justice Rehnquist, and they felt Faye v. Noya was too lenient, that it didn't really show enough respect for state court decisions.
Okay.
They were worried that Faye, it allowed prisoners to sandbag, meaning, hold back on a constitutional claim at trial, hoping for an acquittal, and then if they're convicted, use it as a secret weapon in federal court.
So they were concerned about people trying to game the system, get two bites at the apple, so to speak.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. But it also seems like that could create some real problems for people who have, legitimate claims.
Yeah. And that's where the debate within the Supreme Court itself gets really interesting. It wasn't a unanimous decision. Not everyone agreed.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Not all the justices were like totally on board with Rehnquist's approach. Some of them, they had some serious concerns, about what this cause and prejudice standard really meant.
So who was, I guess, leading the charge against the majority opinion?
Justice Brennan, yeah. He wrote a pretty fiery dissent. He argued that the cause and prejudice standard, it was way too rigid. Like, it would unfairly punish defendants for mistakes that weren't even their fault. Imagine, your freedom could depend on whether or not your lawyer happened to miss an objection.
That seems, I mean, really unfair, especially when you think about what's at stake in a criminal trial. Exactly. And that was Brennan's point. He was like, closing the door to federal review just because of a lawyer's error. That's a huge injustice. He really believed that. More often than not, these procedural defaults, they weren't some deliberate choice by the defendant. It was, the attorney negligence.
So he was saying, let's not blame the defendant for their lawyer's fumble.
Right. Exactly. He argued that the deliberate bypass standard from Faye v. Noya, where the focus was on what the defendant intended to do, that was a much better way to balance things out. Like, you need some finality in court proceedings, but you also have this fundamental right to challenge a conviction that's unlawful.
So he was really trying to protect defendants from being penalized for something that was totally out of their control.
He was, but Brennan wasn't alone in this. Even some of the justices who agreed with the outcome of the case, they still had reservations about, how strictly this cause and prejudice test would actually be applied. Like Chief Justice Berger, he wrote a concurring opinion, and he was worried that defendants might end up serving time for their lawyers' mistakes.
Oh, wow. I mean, we all make mistakes, but in this context, a lawyer's mistake, it could have like really, really serious consequences.
For sure, for sure. You're right on. That was the key point that Berger was making. He was arguing that there's a difference between a lawyer making some strategic decision, right? And a lawyer just straight up messing up. You can't just treat those two situations the same.
So he was saying, hold on, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We need to consider the context of these procedural errors.
Yes, exactly. And Justice Stevens, he also concurred with the majority, and he kind of echoed that same idea. He pointed out that trials, they're super complex, they're fast-paced. Lawyers have to make these split-second decisions under so much pressure. And even the best lawyers, they can miss things, they make mistakes.
It's a high-pressure environment for sure. It's like, I don't know, trying to juggle chainsaws while riding a unicycle.
Yeah, that's a good one. Stevens was basically saying, this cause and prejudice test, it shouldn't just automatically shut down every appeal just because there was a procedural misstep, right? There needs to be some wiggle room, Some space for fairness, for flexibility.
It sounds like what you're saying is we've got this whole spectrum of opinions on the court, right? You've got Rehnquist over here with this very strict interpretation of procedural rules, and then you've got Brennan on the other side, the strong defense of defendants' rights. But ultimately, the majority did rule against Sykes, right?
They did, yeah. That meant his appeal was basically, it was over. He couldn't meet that cause and prejudice standard.
Even though he was like trying to raise this serious constitutional issue about his confession, this one procedural misstep was a total roadblock.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the reality of Wainwright v. Sykes. It really underscores just how crucial these procedural rules are and, what can happen, the consequences when those rules aren't followed.
I can imagine what that must have meant for defense attorneys all over the country, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly every objection, every procedural step, it's a potential minefield.
Oh, absolutely. Wainwright v. Sykes, it sent a very clear message to lawyers. It was like, don't mess around with these rules. Your client's future could depend on it.
Wow. It's amazing how one case can have this ripple effect through, like, the entire legal system.
Hmm.
So what about the long-term legacy of Wainwright v. Sykes? How has this case shaped the legal landscape over the, you know, past few decades?
It's had a big impact. It definitely shifted the power dynamic, you know, kind of in favor of state courts. It made federal habeas review a lot harder to get. Wainwright kind of set the stage for a whole bunch of Supreme Court decisions that, well, they basically limited the power of federal courts to, like, overturn state convictions.
So it wasn't just a one-off ruling. It started a trend, like, towards giving more deference to state courts in habeas corpus cases.
Exactly. It became much harder for prisoners to, like, raise constitutional claims in federal court if they hadn't followed all the right procedures in state court. And that brings us to some important questions,
yeah,
you know, about what Wainwright means for individual rights and the overall balance of power in our justice system.
Yeah, that seems like that's really the core of this whole thing.
Uh-huh.
On the one hand, you want a system that's fair and efficient, right? Rules and procedures are important. You need that to keep things moving, prevent these endless appeals. But on the other hand, you don't want to sacrifice individual rights just for the sake of efficiency.
Right. Absolutely. And that's where Wainwright v. Sykes really throws a wrench into the system. The right to a fair trial, the ability to challenge an unlawful conviction, those are like the cornerstones of our justice system. So the question is, how do we balance those super important values with this need for clear rules and procedures?
It's a real dilemma. It's like walking a tightrope between order and justice.
That's a great way to put it. And it's why this case continues to be so debated, so analyzed even today. Some legal scholars, they argue that the cause and prejudice test, it's just too rigid. It puts too much of a burden on defendants, especially ones who might not have had, you know, good legal representation in the first place.
And especially when you consider we're not just talking about some abstract legal concept here, right? These are real people's lives. We're talking about freedom, potentially even life or death.
You're absolutely right. The stakes are so high. And that's what makes this case so compelling. It forces us to think about these really tough questions, like how do we make sure justice is served while still respecting the rules of the game?
So we've gone through this complex legal maze, you know, created by Wainwright v. Sykes. We've looked at the arguments, the different opinions, the lasting impact. But I'm curious, where does John Sykes himself fit into all of this? What happened to him after the Supreme Court made their decision?
Yeah, sadly, Sykes, he stayed in prison after the appeal was denied. But his case, it really did bring to light the potential for injustice, you know, when you have these procedural errors that kind of overshadow legitimate claims, claims about constitutional violations.
It's a good reminder that behind all these legal cases, there's a human story. And sometimes those stories, they get kind of lost in all the details of the legal processes. But his case, it did have a wider impact though, right?
It did, yeah. Wainwright v. Sykes, it wasn't just about one man and his confession. It sparked this national conversation about how we balance these procedural rules with fundamental rights. And that's a conversation that's still going on today.
So as we're kind of wrapping up our deep dive into Wainwright v. Sykes, I'm thinking about, you know, what a more just and equitable system would look like.
Mm.
Is there a way to balance this need for clear rules and procedures with this fundamental right to a fair trial? What about making it so hard for people to challenge their convictions?
That's the question, isn't it? It's the question that lawyers and judges and legal scholars, they're all thinking about it, trying to figure it out every day. Cases like Wainwright v. Sykes, they force us to look at the limits of our justice system and to keep looking for ways to make it fairer and more effective for everyone.
It makes me wonder, have there been any cases since Wainwright that have tried to maybe, I don't know, clarify or even challenge this cause and prejudice standard?
There have been, definitely, a bunch of cases that have built on Wainwright, and they haven't really made it any easier for prisoners who were trying to get federal habeas relief. One that really sticks out is Coleman v. Thompson. It was 1991. In Coleman, the Supreme Court kind of took Wainwright even further. They ruled that even if a lawyer makes a mistake during the state appeals process, that doesn't count as cause for procedural default.
So even if there's a clear mistake by the lawyer during appeals, the prisoner is still stuck with that.
Yeah, essentially. That's what Coleman said. The court was basically saying, you have to raise your claims the right way in those initial state proceedings. If you don't, you're out of luck. So it made a tough situation even tougher for prisoners trying to get their cases heard in federal court.
That seems really harsh. What about those situations where there's new evidence, like evidence that proves someone is innocent that comes up after the trial? Should those procedural defaults still apply then?
That is a tricky question. It really gets at the heart of what's more important, you know?
Yeah.
Do we value procedural efficiency more, or making absolutely sure that innocent people don't end up in prison?
Yeah.
It's a tough one.
I was thinking about it like, imagine you're playing a board game, right? Mm. And halfway through the game, you realize that your opponent, they've been cheating this whole time, but you didn't say anything at the beginning because you didn't notice. Mm. So do you just keep playing and let them win, even though you know it's not fair?
That's a great analogy. And it really captures that ethical dilemma, you know, that judges and lawyers face in these cases. There isn't an easy answer. On one hand, you've got this principle of finality. Court decisions need to be final at some point. People need to be able to move on. But you can't just ignore evidence of innocence because of some, you know, technicality.
So how do courts try to balance those two things?
It's a constant balancing act, for sure. There are some really narrow exceptions to that cause and prejudice rule. Like, if a prisoner can show actual innocence, like maybe through DNA evidence that wasn't available at the time of the trial, then federal courts might be a little more willing to overlook the procedural default.
So there's a tiny bit of hope there.
Yeah, just a sliver.
But it's a very narrow path.
Very narrow. And that's why Wainwright v. Sykes, it remains a really controversial case. It brings up all these fundamental questions about fairness, due process, the role of federal courts in protecting rights.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Wainwright v. Sykes, what are the key takeaways, especially for law students or anyone who's interested in criminal justice? What can we really learn from Sykes' story, from this case?
I think, first and foremost, Wainwright v. Sykes, it just shows how crucial defense attorneys are. Every decision they make, every objection they raise, every objection they don't raise, it can have huge consequences.
It puts a lot of weight on their shoulders.
It does. They're not just, like, playing a role in some courtroom drama. They're advocating for someone's freedom.
Absolutely, yeah.
This case shows how important it is for defense attorneys to be super vigilant, to be on top of those procedural rules, and make sure their clients' rights are protected every step of the way.
So it's a reminder that legal battles, they're often won or lost on procedure.
That's a great way to put it. It also makes us think about the balance of power between state and federal courts and how important it is for people to be able to access federal review, you know, when they're challenging a conviction.
It's a complex issue, and there aren't any easy answers. But cases like Wainwright v. Sykes, they make us face these questions and really think about how our justice system works.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So for our listeners, if you're interested in learning more about this, where should you start?
I would say definitely read the Wainwright v. Sykes decision itself. It's really interesting to read, and you get to see the different opinions of the court. Also, look into some of the cases that came after Wainwright, like we talked about, Coleman v. Thompson. You'll see how the Supreme Court has continued to, like, wrestle with these issues.
So Wainwright really opened up a door, like, to a whole new area of legal debate and analysis.
It did. It did. And those debates, they're still happening. So if you're interested, do some of your own research, read the cases, and come to your own conclusions.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. And to our listeners, keep those legal minds engaged. Remember, justice is a journey, not a destination. Keep learning, keep questioning, and keep striving for a more just and equitable world.